Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I see some familiar faces in the auditorium. Ben Schneider, one of the readers for my dissertation at Princeton, and I guess one of the reasons why I'm actually here today. And I see several of my former students, and I'm very proud that they're here. I hope they've forgiven me for the famous, infamous resúmenes. And now that they're here, they know why I forced them to write them. As I reflect on my troubled country, the troubled country for many of you who are sitting in this room, the lyrics of a Bruce Springsteen song come to mind. We are far, far away from home. Our home is far, far away from us. And that's how it feels to live in Mexico during these turbulent times, far from democratic normalcy, far from the rule of law, far from home, and very close to everything that imperils it, always on the lookout, suspicious of our own shadow, invaded by the legitimate fear of walking on the street after dark, taking money out of an ATM machine, hopping into a cab, being stopped by a policeman, receiving the call of a kidnapper saying that he has taken your child, losing a son, burying a daughter. My home, our home, has become a place where too many people die, gunned down by a drug trafficker or assaulted by a robber or shot by an ill-trained police officer or kidnapped and strangled by the member of a criminal gang, as was the case of the teenage children of Alejandro Martí, who was here yesterday. In a country where over 7,000 people have died over the last year in drug-related violence, it's not a surprise that insecurity is top of mind for many Mexicans. And given the increasingly lawless conditions of the country he inherited, Felipe Calderón had little choice but to act. The former ruling party that governed Mexico in an authoritarian fashion for 71 years left behind a toxic legacy. During the 1980s, drug trafficking blossomed throughout the country as a result of political protection. Drug traffickers infiltrated the Mexican government, frequently aided and abetted by members of the federal judicial police, as well as state-level officials. The political structure built by the PRI provided a shell for organized crime that was able to swell despite the government, and thanks to the blind eye that it often turned. So I think dealing with a problem that had become so ingrained and so embedded has been difficult for Felipe Calderón because the surge in drug trafficking in Mexico reflects a painful paradox. The government's drug enforcement efforts are often undermined by the corrupting influence of the drug trade, yet the drug trade cannot survive without the political protection of compromised elements in the government itself. Cocaine dealers, for example, spend as much as $500 million a year on bribery, which is more than double the budget of the Mexican Attorney General's office. So as a result, it's very difficult to distinguish those charged with smuggling from the smugglers themselves. Policemen regularly play dual roles. They act as drug enforcers and as drug smuggling protectors. In places like Tijuana last year, Chihuahua, as I speak, the army has effectively been brought in to protect citizens from the police. Mexico is a place where, as you know, if you are the victim of a crime, the last person you call is a police officer. In the face of police corruption, Felipe Calderón has turned to the military to take on the anti-drug effort. But bringing soldiers out of the barracks and moving them around the country at will is a cause for concern. As a result of its expanded role, the military is becoming the supreme authority, in some cases the only authority, in some parts of some states. And greater militarization is also leading to greater corruption within an institution that has turned into the last credible beachhead in Mexico's longstanding battle. So using the military as a roving cleanup force may solve some short-term problems, but will also create other intractable ones. I think that in order to be more effective, Felipe Calderón has to not deal only with Mexico's drug trafficking scourge, but with the culture of illegality. Over the past decade, the surge in drug trafficking and Calderón's efforts, the efforts to contain its effects, are symptomatic of what doesn't work in Mexico's dysfunctional democracy. As George Orwell wrote, we denounce the war, we denounce wars, while preserving the type of society that makes them inevitable. Mexico has a political, economic, and social structure that makes crime possible. It is a country characterized by politicians who protect drug traffickers and drug traffickers who finance politicians, by those who launder money and unregulated financial institutions that allow the practice to occur, by judges who become accomplices of criminals and criminals who can and do bribe them. And although Felipe Calderón has declared that the Mexican government is winning the war against the drug mafias, the truth is that government institutions too frequently shelter their members. Drug trafficking in Mexico is nurtured by extensive corruption and persistent impunity. It feeds upon a country where 85% of crimes are never reported due to lack of trust in the institutions, and where 98%, please keep this number in your mind, 98% of crimes are never resolved or punished. So while Felipe Calderón's efforts are to be applauded, the prospects for a stable, less insecure Mexico will be contingent on Calderón's capacity to enact a major overhaul of the country's judiciary and law enforcement apparatus. It will be dependent on the government's political will to confront corruption at the highest levels, something he has been reluctant to do. In other words, the Mexican president needs to fight not only drug traffickers, but also the political networks that protect them. Otherwise, Mexico will continue to combat symptoms while ignoring causes. Now, Calderón has told the United States that the heightened level of violence that we're witnessing today is the result of government efficiency in combating drug cartels, and the rise in executions is evidence of a firm hand and not an ineffectual one. But Calderón's stance, his position that Mexico is winning this war, one that he is forced to maintain due to political and electoral imperatives at home, sidesteps structural problems that cannot be solved with more weapons, more bullets, more members of the military policing key cities, more blood on the street, more simplistic solutions to complex problems. The current strategy, based, as you know, on the increased militarization of Mexico, does not deal with, as I said, high-level corruption that no one really wants to combat. It ignores a police force so weak, so ill-trained, so underpaid, and so infiltrated that the good apples are spoiled by rotten ones. It ignores that the enhanced military presence is resulting in more human rights abuses in a country where there are already too many of them. It doesn't deal with a concentrated, oligopolistic economic structure that thwarts growth and social mobility, forcing people across the border or into the drug trade in record numbers. 450,000 Mexicans, according to official counts, are involved in the cultivation, processing, and distribution of drugs, according to a recent estimate. And the current strategy ignores the existence of a permanent subclass of over 20 million people who live on less than $20 a day and who view drug cultivation as a way out of extreme poverty. Drug trafficking activities are becoming more persistent in Mexico due to historic recalcitrant patterns that recent governments have failed to confront. If Mexico is unable to deal with its domestic corruption, it doesn't matter how many troops are trained, how many weapons are shipped, and how many helicopters are bought. Colombia has spent over $5 billion in U.S. aid with mixed results. No end to drug protection, but yes, to drug production, but yes, more security. So the lesson seems to be clear. The main objective of the war that the Mexican government is waging should not only be the destruction of the drug cartels, but also the construction of the rule of law. The construction of the rule of law. Because people refer to the rule of law in Mexico, el Estado de Derecho, as if it existed. At the same time, this is a war that will never be won, that will never end with a certain triumph of the forces of good over the forces of evil if the demand for drugs is not stymied. To pretend that it can be won without dealing with drug consumption and demand-driven forces in the United States is to believe that one can stop an earthquake or a hurricane. For every drug trafficker who is caught, another one will emerge in his place, as is already occurring in Mexico. As Detective McNulty says in the final scene of The Wire, which I hope you've seen, as Alessandra Stanley of the New York Times once said, there's television and then there's The Wire. If you've seen The Wire, McNulty says, as he gazes on the city that he policed, Baltimore, that series that recreated the futile war against drugs, as he looks upon it with a mixture of love and sadness, he says, it is what it is. And his despair is shared by many Mexicans today as we pay a very high price for American veracity. But we also pay a very high price for our inability to construct a prosperous, dynamic, inclusive, lawful country in which citizens aren't propelled into illicit activities in order to survive, and criminals are not protected by the government itself. In the debate over whether Mexico is a failed state or not, I think the position one ought to take is that it's not a failed state according to the foreign policy guideline. It's an infiltrated state. Today, the Mexican state declares that it is winning the war against los malos, the bad guys, when it is providing a safe haven for them. Where are the governors who have been indicted, the municipal presidents who have been accused, the senators who are under investigation, the attorney generals who are being sought after for their protection, for the activities that they use to protect drug traffickers at the local level, the military personnel who's been accused. We don't see any of that happening in Mexico today, and I think that is reflective of the web of corruption that is protecting drug trafficking in Mexico and has done so for many years. To change that, Mexico will have to confront some very hard truths. As Alejandro Martí surely said to you yesterday, it doesn't matter how many councils are installed, speeches are given, commitments are made, promises are put on the table. Mexico will continue to be the convulsed country it is today until criminals are actually punished. And that will never occur until and unless the icons of impunity inhabit our collective house. It will never occur while those who violate, who break the law, continue to live in our collective house instead of being removed from there. So, how much credibility can the famous Acuerdo por la Seguridad, la Legalidad y la Justicia, signed, I guess it was last year after Alejandro Martí's son was killed, how much credibility can that accord have when Mario Marín, protector of pedophiles, governor of Puebla, subscribes it? How much credibility can an initiative to sanction kidnapping have when Ulises Ruiz, responsible for, as you know, flagrant human rights abuses in Oaxaca, subscribes it? How much credibility can an effort to promote transparency have when Carlos Romero de Champs, the head of the oil workers union, the man with the $80,000 Rolex watches, how much credibility can that initiative sign have when he is brought in to sign it? What possibility of success can a crusade to combat corruption have when it is led by the people who have participated in those corrupt activities? And we are told in Mexico all the time, the root of everything, the root of all ills is impunity. Impunity, says Felipe Calderón. He is absolutely right. The problem is that the president and many other members of Mexico's political class speak about impunity as if it were this thing floating out there in the stratosphere, as if it were not related to conduct that they have contributed to institutionalize, as if impunity were completely delinked from their own behavior, as if the fault should only lie with apathetic citizens and a society that has lost its values, as we're frequently told, as if impunity in Mexico had not been fed by venal governors and corrupt union leaders and presidents who chose to turn a blind eye, as if impunity had not become a condition, sine qua non, of the Mexican political system, a system built upon a structure of guaranteed impunity, shared complicity, assured protection, a system that survives despite things that we can applaud, like the transparency law, like the Federal Electoral Institute, things that electoral democracy has brought with it. But the underbelly of that of the system, of the old system, prevails in Mexico today because it was never dismantled. And therefore, I think that the real challenge for Mexican society today, for people like Alejandro Martí and others who are calling for an hasta aquí, nevermore, that would entail combating impunity in the places where it was born and where it developed and where it grew. And where was impunity in Mexico born and developed, and where did it grow? Well, let's start with Los Pinos and the army and the teachers' union and the oil workers' union and the Ministry of Gobernación and the Quinta Colorada in Tabasco and the governorship of Puebla and the mansions of Arturo Montiel. Because if we are not able to detect that that's where impunity comes from and raise the bar, as Alejandro Martí has urged us to do, and understand the damage that impunity has caused to the whole political structure and how it feeds into drug trafficking, we will never be able to comfortably inhabit the home that I am referring to. Because in the meantime, the people who live in that home are starting to call for what? And this is a very negative byproduct of the situation of insecurity that we live in today. You hear it now all the time. The demand for order, the demand for authority, the petition for a strong hand, Mexicans calling for someone who can actually govern the country. And we seem to be headed towards what I call a regrettable Putinization of Mexico, a regression to that mental state where Mexicans begin to feel a nostalgia for strong men, a la Vladimir Putin. And that temptation is clear in the face of the killings, of the kidnappings, of the beheadings, of the drug traffickers who are cornering the Mexican state and showing just how fragile that state has become. And in the face of this panorama, there is an increasing number of citizens who seem willing to give up their incipient democratic freedoms in return for security. In every cafe conversation in Mexico today, I challenge you, you will hear this. You will hear someone saying, el retorno del PRI, the return of the PRI, because this didn't happen with them. In the absence of national and social cohesion, too many Mexicans are calling for a firm hand. In the absence of trust among citizens, too many Mexicans are calling for the return of someone who can save Mexicans from themselves. Someone con pantalones que pise fuerte, que viole las reglas de ser necesario. It's not a surprise that democracy and you see it in the polls, is beginning to be associated with anarchy, with weakness, with insecurity. It's not a surprise that people are clamoring for the return of a Mexican Putin, someone, some party, some political force that can offer continuity, security, stability, control. And who is offering that? The old free. Led by unsavory characters like Manlio Fabio Beltrones and Emilio Gamboa and Ulises Ruiz, offering the PRI with the pretty face of Enrique Peña Nieto, the governor of the state of Mexico, and the steel glove of Beltrones, who was the secretario particular of Fernando Gutiérrez Barrios, infamous leader of Mexico's security forces in the 60s and 70s. And what is this particular group offering Mexico? To the TV networks, the maintenance of the duopoly. To the business elite, the reestablishment of order and security. To the unions, the preservation of their conquistas sindicales, their famous derechos adquiridos. Did you know that in Mexico, one of these derechos adquiridos, these acquired rights, is the right to sell your position as a teacher in a public school or inherit it to your children or exchange it for sexual favors? The PRI is offering the unions the maintenance of those acquired rights. And it is offering Mexicans the value of experience, even if that experience is anti-democratic. And that's what we're beginning to see on the political and electoral horizon of Mexico. A PRI that is establishing an alliance between the oligarchs and the forces of order, supported by a population that is beginning to lose its democratic impetus. So we're seeing perhaps the restoration of a firm but corrupt hand that strangled Mexico for 71 years. I reiterate, a regrettable Putinization. Why has this turned out to be the case? We have a dysfunctional democracy, and I'm referring to the rules that govern Mexico's institutional arrangements today. Think about it for a minute. Presidential system, but with a divided government in which there's no re-election. The worst of all worlds, because there is no incentive for opposition parties to collaborate with the government. So Felipe Calderón has been forced to seek accords with his worst enemies, the PRI, by offering constant carrots to his adversaries. Carrots that include the political survival of Ulises Ruiz and Mario Marín. Carrots that bring the PRI, yes, to the table and lead it to negotiate with the president in Congress, but carrots that also turn the president into a hostage of his adversaries. Adversaries that do pact, that do reach accords, but only in their own terms. The PRI today, to Felipe Calderón, is the enemy he has been forced to sleep with a knife under his bed. The PRI is the semi-loyal opposition that raised Felipe Calderón's hand and gave him the legitimacy he needed to reach the presidency after the contested election in 2006. But it's the adversary that constantly twists the president's back, behind his back. And this is an alliance that Calderón and the National Action Party have been forced to enter into in order to govern the country. The PAN has had no choice but to invite, seduce, broker, bargain with the PRI at a very high cost. Because yes, the president obtains the agreements he needs in Congress, 5 reforms, distancing himself from the paralysis that plagued Vicente Fox's administration. But at the same time, by doing so, he has empowered this opposition that pacts with him, but always diluting the terms of the reforms because of the vested interests that the PRI is constantly defending. By joining hands with the PRI, with the representatives of the worst part of the PRI, the president has been unable to break with the past. By allying himself with those who remain emblematic of the worst practices of Mexico's authoritarian past. He cannot denounce them. He has contributed to clean the face of the priestas who are now coming back to power. By pacting with Emilio Gamboa and Manlio Fabio Beltrones, the president, is allowing them to come back. And over the past 2.5 years, what has the PRI been doing? It has been reorganizing itself at the state and local level, winning election after election in the periphery with the hope of reconquering the center, reconquering the presidency in 2012. It takes advantage of internal divisions in the National Action Party. It takes advantage of the disintegration or the weaknesses of the Mexican left. 2 years after its incredible fall from grace, once again in the 2006 election, the PRI today is the main force, political force in the country. It is the main adversary for the National Action Party. It is no longer Andrés Manuel López Obrador and the PRD. And in contrast with the divisions that led the PRI to lose in 2000 and 2006, the PRI today displays an incredible amount of discipline. Personal infighting, ideological differences have all been subsumed under the main objective, and that is to win the next midterm election and then go on to win the next presidential race. And it's coming back. If Beatriz Paredes were here, she would say, "What do you mean we're coming back? We never left." And the PRI is there today, not because of what it offers, but because of the political vacuum that it's filling. It comes back by default. It comes back with discredited leaders. It comes back because it can. And it's using all of the traditional elements at its disposal to achieve that objective. Money, intimidation, clientelist mobilization, low levels of participation, and the weaknesses of the electoral institutes at the state level. And in returning in the way in which it does, it sends a message that in order to return, it doesn't have to modernize. It can be the same party that it always was, and it can still return to power. Why? Because the country it governed, in many ways, is still the same country. Electoral democracy has not been as a transformative force as many of us had wished for. And because el pequeño priista que muchos mexicanos llevan dentro, the small priista that many Mexicans carry inside themselves, is still alive. That small priista for whom paying taxes is an option, not an obligation. Stopping at a red light is an option, not an obligation. Corruption is legitimate when it's shared. Corruption in Mexico is not a deal breaker. And the results of this particular dynamic are there for all to see. Manlio Fabio Beltrones has become one of the most powerful men in Mexico, despite that series in the New York Times that won the Pulitzer Prize over 10 years ago, linking him to drug trafficking activities when he was governor of the state of Sonora. And poll after poll shows Enrique Peña Nieto, governor of the state of Mexico, the most popular person in the country, just below Felipe Calderón. Poll after poll reveals the PRI in a very competitive position, the party that so many people in Mexico worked to toss out has the real chance of winning the midterms and positioning itself to return in 2012. And this situation is also the product of the tremendous dysfunctionality of the Mexican left and the inability of the left to figure out to this day what to do with Andrés Manuel López Obrador. There you have it, a couple in tandem, they do not know how to behave as one. The PRD and Andrés Manuel López Obrador, confronted on what seems like a double bed that has become a battle force, a battleground. There are the different factions of the left throwing plates, ridiculing each other, calling each other names, fighting over turf, fighting over positioning, fighting over everything, emulating on a daily basis. And if you follow the Mexican newspapers, you know what I'm talking about. The wonderful Ingmar Bergman movie, Scenes from a Marriage, and revealing as many confrontations as its protagonists. A left that is unhappily wedded, unhappily married, and because of this, politically weakened. A left that has managed to transform what was an incredible electoral performance in 2006 into what will most likely be a major political defeat in the midterm elections. Its poll numbers show the party today at its lowest ever historically, 14%. A left that was capable of accumulating an extraordinary amount of political capital to simply toss it out, because the costs in which this left is incurring are becoming increasingly obvious. The only thing that the PRD has managed to do is to force the National Action Party into this marriage of convenience with the PRI, force Felipe Calderón a bailar siempre con la más fea, forcing Felipe Calderón to keep on courting the most corrupt people in the landscape of Mexican government. And if he were here today, he would say, I wanted to negotiate with the left, but I couldn't find interlocutors after the 2006 election. And this situation is putting the PRD into a position where day after day it's losing support and votes and the possibility of changing Mexico without blowing it up first. And why is further change needed? Because electoral democracy, what we've seen up to now, is simply not enough. The country's political system has become a peculiar hybrid combination of authoritarian remnants and newly established mechanisms for alternancia and transparency, unions, political parties, vested interests, public and private monopolies have not learned to adapt to the more democratic circumstances. They are exploiting them to their advantage by becoming veto centers, opposed to further economic and political reform. Mexico's democracy is haunted by the old demons of corruption, patrimonialism, rent-seeking. And in contrast with the past, when the problem was Mexico's imperial presidency, and that was one of the key obstacles to democratic evolution, the concentration of power has been replaced by its dispersion. The problem today in Mexico is not too much power in the hands of the president, but too much power seized by all of those who want to preserve their privileged position in the status quo. I frequently compare Felipe Calderón to Gulliver, the protagonist of Jonathan Swift's novella, who wakes up after a storm and discovers himself the prisoner on a beach, tied down by multiple small men. And in the case of Felipe Calderón, a woman, Elvester Gordillo. So what the former imperial presidency has given up or been forced to concede, a divided Congress has gained. What the executive has relinquished, vested interests have been quick to pick up. What the Mexican state is no longer able to assure, the monopoly of violence, drug traffickers and organized crime have taken advantage of. So Mexico's democracy today presents serious problems that condemn it to what I call low-grade representation. Mexico's democratization, its further democratization, has been stalled by its bad institutional design. Political parties that too frequently appear very far removed from citizen demands, prone to divisions, incapable of attending deep-rooted problems of inequality and lawlessness, and prone to presenting authoritarian strains of leadership, whether on the left or on the right, that attempt to portray themselves as a redemptive force capable of saving the country. Mexico, I think, exhibits today a low-grade democracy characterized by parties that are well-financed, but not representative, by rules that allow elite rotation but don't assure accountability, because we're the only country on the planet, aside from Costa Rica, that does not have legislative re-election. So this is an arrangement that benefits Mexico's political class, and I'd say its business establishment, much more than it does its citizens. And why is this a problem? Because for the Mexicans sitting here, the topic of how to modernize Mexico is one that we've been debating for over 20 years. We never seem to make it. We're a privileged country. We have an extraordinary geographic location. We have incredible natural resources. We are inhabited by millions of talented, productive people. And despite that, year after year, we don't grow as much as we could. We don't move as quickly as we should. Remember that wonderful survey of Mexico in The Economist entitled Mexico, Time to Wake Up. Why do we not wake up? Well, I'd ask you, in order to respond to that question, to accompany me on a small intellectual journey. And remember that famous book by Madame Calderón de la Barca, written several centuries ago, called La Vida en México, Life in Mexico. If Madame Calderón de la Barca were alive today and landed in Mexico and wrote a book about what she saw, she would have to change its title. It wouldn't be called La Vida en México. It would be called Oligopoly Land. Because from the moment she set foot in the country, what would she experience? She would land in one of the most expensive airports in the world. She would be surrounded by maleteros, you know, who monopolize the service. If she were to take a taxi, she would have to deal with a company that decreed its an increment in its tariffs by 30% without any sort of government approval. If she were to get gas, she could only do it in Pemex. In the hotel, there would be a 75% chance that if she ate a tortilla, it would have been provided by only one distributor. If she got a stomachache and needed to go to a drugstore, she would discover that the medicines there are much more expensive than in other places in the world. And if she called her husband long distance to complain about the situation, she would pay among the highest rates of any country of the OECD. And if she turned on the TV to distract herself from the bad situation she's encountered, she would discover that there are only two networks. And in order to understand what she's facing, she'd have to reflect on what the president of the Bank of Mexico said recently: Mexico has not figured out how to use its resources in an effective manner. She would have to read the book Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism, that explains why some countries prosper and others stagnate, why some countries are able to promote equality and others simply cannot do so. And the authors of that book argue that the answer lies in the type of capitalism that a country is able to create. The key to success lies in the establishment of democratic capitalism over its alternatives. What are the other bad alternatives? Oligarchic capitalism, state-run capitalism. Mexico today is a classic example of what Joseph Stiglitz has called, and others, crony capitalism, el capitalismo de cuates. Capitalism that is not based on competition or on innovation, but on blocking both of them. And if you look at the Mexican economy today, you will discover a structure that is paralyzed by dominant positions and bottlenecks in key sectors. Sectors that explain, that are fundamental to the growth of any economy. What are those sectors? Telecommunications, financial services, transportation, energy. I'd include education in there as well. If you look at the bottlenecks in those sectors today, you'll understand what keeps holding the Mexican economy back: a mixture of oligarchic capitalism and state-led capitalism. And Mexico today, immersed in a global crisis, is still very far From that sort of capitalism where the state does not protect privileges, defend fiefdoms, choose winners, and allow the perpetuation of a small group of oligarchs with the power to veto reforms that affect them. Mexico is, in other words, paying the price of 20 years of badly instrumented reforms. Those efforts carried out in the 1980s and 90s to privatize, liberalize, deregulate, did not produce a dynamic market economy due to the absence of effective government regulation capable of creating functional markets. Instead of transparency and clear rules, discretionality prevailed among the businessmen who benefited from those privatizations and government officials in charge of implementing them. Agustin Carstens, the head of Hacienda, several weeks ago made a comment about how one of the key problems Mexico faced was monopolies in telecommunications. And when I heard him, I thought, that statement is a welcome one. Unfortunately, it's been made 18 years too late. 18 years after Teléfonos de México was privatized. And the results of these reforms, I think well-intentioned but badly implemented, are there and explain the triple play that I'm alluding to in this talk: drugs, dinosaurs, and dithering. An economy that doesn't grow enough, a business elite that doesn't compete enough, an economic model that concentrates wealth and distributes badly the wealth that is created. Mexico today is being held back by an intricate web of privileges and business vetoes and dominant positions that inhibit the construction of a level playing field. It's a network that operates on the basis of favors and concessions and regulatory protection that the government offers and the business elite in Mexico demands in order to invest. Who demands this? Well, let's see. Someone like the owner of a corn distribution company, or the concesionario of a private highway, or someone who's bought a bank rescued by Fobaproa, or the main stockholder in Telmex, or the operator of an Afore. These actors have been able to capture rents through the exploitation, through the manipulation of the economic environment, instead of creating wealth through innovation. And the consumers of Mexico contribute to the rents every time they pay their phone bill, every time they pay their internet connection, every time they pay the toll on that private highway, every time they pay their commission for a credit card or an Afore. Example after example of rents extracted through the manipulation of markets. And what is this producing in Mexico? Rent seeking, as you know, accentuates inequality, produces social costs, inhibits growth, makes the transaction costs in the Mexican economy much higher than they should be, thereby limiting Mexican competitiveness. And these dominant players have erected very high barriers to entry to new players. And there's an even more perverse impact of what I'm saying. The concentration of wealth and power in these dominant players all too frequently translates into what? Unfair advantages, regulatory capture, public policies that benefit particular interests, and even worse yet, they are capable of transforming the representatives of the public interest, congressmen, senators, cabinet members, into employees of the vested interests of Mexico. And that's why I'm frequently plagued by these questions, questions that I ask myself every night. Who governs Mexico? Who governs Mexico? The Senate, or Ricardo Salinas Pliego, when he is able to intervene in the legislative process and get a law that would have promoted more competition in the banking sector frozen? Who governs? The Ministry of Communications and Transportation, or UNEFON? who governs, the National Banking Commission or the banks that merrily ignore the demands for greater transparency that the law is pushing them to make public? Who governs? The Ministry of Education or El Mester Gordillo? The Federal Competition Commission or Carlos Slim? Pemex or Carlos Romero de Champs? Because in the face of this vacuum of authority, in the face of regulatory capture, in the face of decisions that all too frequently benefit a minority, it's no surprise that many people talk about Mexico as a country that has a state within the state, or refer to it as an economy that doesn't have a government capable of regulating it in an effective manner. This is Mexico's key problem. It's not the decline in oil production. This is what is condemning Mexico to chronic underperformance. And time and again, the debate in my country, in the country of many of those who are sitting in this room, the debate over how to promote investment, create jobs, ignite growth, is out of focus. The government believes that the way to achieve this goal is to promote private investment in key sectors, in energy, for example, or in transportation, in infrastructure. And the private sector believes that that's the panacea, that that's what's going to pull Mexico out of the hole. But that is only a partial solution to a deeper problem. The real root of Mexico's economic mediocrity, it lies in its economic structure, a structure that is too top-heavy, heavy at the top, an oligopolistic structure in which a small group of people dedicate themselves to rent-seeking, a structure based on complicity and collusion that the government allows and has become a beneficiary of. And of course, if there were members of Calderón's economic team here, they would say, oh, no, growth is a priority for us. But if you look at public policy decisions, you'll realize that it's a residual variable. I think that what they've been trying to do, and it's very painful to recognize this as a Mexican citizen, is to assure stability, a certain degree of advance in order to maintain social peace, but without changing the fundamentals of Mexico's economic structure. And the problem today is that that structure has created monsters. That structure has produced people and monopolies and duopolies and unions that can no longer be controlled. Those creatures of the state, as Moises Naim, the editor of Foreign Policy, calls them, that today threaten to devour the Mexican state. And only in this light can you explain why Vicente Fox's government gave back 500 million pesos to Ricardo Salinas Pliego the day before Fox left office, allegedly because he'd overpaid his taxes. Only through this framework can you understand why the Ministry of Communications and Transportation last year would issue a communique celebrating the alliance between Televisa and Telemundo, when in reality that alliance meant that there was not going to be, in the rest of this administration, a third television network. Only through this framework can you understand why no one in Mexico raises a finger to sanction Ricardo Salinas Pliego when he refuses to show the spots from the Federal Electoral Institute, or he takes over the Cerro del Chiquihuite. Only through this framework can you understand why the infamous Ley Televisa was approved in 2006 with, 354 votes in favor, no votes against, zero abstentions, by a chamber of deputies that was completely controlled by the political interests of the networks. Only through this framework can you understand why the reform of Pemex did not touch, ni con el pétalo de una rosa, the oil workers' union. All of these are signs of, in my view, an ineffectual government, a colluded government, a government that no longer knows how to deal with these creatures of the state. And the effects of this are becoming more and more obvious. The fact that we have not been able to reform ourselves in time. Concentrated wealth, few beneficiaries, growth, stagnant growth, a country that lags behind its competitors, vested interest, diluted reforms, very little competition, low competitiveness, concentrated power, dysfunctional democracy, a government that, instead of domesticating the creatures it has produced, now lives in terror of them. And what are the consequences of what I'm speaking of? Where traditional elites are strong, democratic governments tend to be inefficient. Political parties tend to be captured. Public policy reforms tend to be minimalist. And the incrementalism of Mexican public policy can be explained by the power of these traditional elites that are blocking reforms in order to maintain their privileged situation in Mexico's economic structure. And what would Mexico need to do to change this structure? Well, begin to reform and regulate in the name of the public interest. Send out clear signs of what is going to be done with those veto centers that are blocking the emergence of democratic capitalism. And who am I talking about? Abusive monopolists and rapacious unions and blackmailing networks and privileged businessmen and their allies in the government. Economic growth should be the priority of the Calderón government. And what should the objective be? The construction of markets, the promotion of competition. In other words, use the power of the state to contain those who today have more power than the government, more weight than the electorate, more interest than the public interest. And I could give you a long list of what the Mexican government would need to do so that you don't come away from this talk thinking, oh, all she does is criticize. If she were president, she wouldn't know what to do. Well, what would you do? What would I do? Licitar una tercera cadena de televisión mañana as a way of breaking up the power of the networks. Promoting competition in broadband through the use of the network of the Federal Electricity Commission. The strengthening of regulatory organizations. The sanction of those who violate the terms of their concession. The creation of markets, as has been done effectively with low-cost airlines. I'm sure many of you have benefited from that functional market in Mexico. Measures that begin to domesticate those creatures of the state and dismantle those bottlenecks. And ultimately, and this is where I'm going to finish, the answer for Mexico is really a political answer. It has to do with the creation of a new sort of relationship between the state and the market and society. Because if the political class of Mexico is unable to construct the foundations of democratic capitalism, it will continue to condemn Mexico to suboptimal performance. It will condemn Mexico to become a fertile ground for populist movements against the establishment, against the institutions. A country that moves sideways due to political institutions it has been unable to make more representative, public and private monopolies it has been unable to dismantle, corporatist structures it has not been able to democratize. It will be what Felipe Calderón calls a country of winners, yes, but where the same people always win. A place where the big fortunes, those on the Forbes list, have been built largely thanks to political protection and not innovation. A place where growth has been much less than in other countries in Latin America due to those bottlenecks that exist and the government has allowed the maintenance of. A place where all of the troubles experienced by my mythical Madame Calderón de la Barca, the troubles she experienced with the taxis and the maleteros and the gas and the telephony and the television networks are the same that are experienced every day by millions of Mexicans. That citizen without a voice, that consumer without protection, that invisible man, that woman without a face, that person who pays month after month the highest telephony rates of any country of the OECD. That student that pays month after month internet connection bills higher than any of the ones that you pay in this country. That company that pays month after month telecom services that elevate its operational costs and dig into its earnings. Thousands of people standing in line outside of the Mexican banks trying to understand what it is they're paying a commission for out there without protection, without representation. Victims of a dysfunctional system institutionalized by a political class that celebrates the approval of reforms that do not go to the heart of the matter. Presidents and cabinet ministers and congressmen and senators that celebrate the consensus to not change, who show a propension to propose minimal reforms, short-term endeavors to elude the that do not take into account the distortions of the economic system, a propension to promote public policy a pedacitos in order to reach a grand consensus to perpetuate the status quo. Well, out there in Mexico, if you follow the newspapers, you've seen 600,000 people who've lost their jobs over the last several months, negative growth, and el lugar 60 en de 134 en el índice global de competitividad. A nation that says it's reforming itself while it tries to avoid doing so. Mexico does not grow and does not prosper and does not move as quickly as it should because of the anti-democratic way in which power is used and shared. It is in this situation because of the discretional and politicized rules that order what Aguilar Camín has called la República Mafiosa. It is in this situation because of the survival of corporatist structures that the government created and continues to finance, an economic model that channels oil rents to too many clientels, a political system that functions very well for its political parties, but functions very badly for its citizens. I call it a system of extraction without representation, creating a country of people who are forced to dilute their hopes, who are forced to shrink their expectations, who are forced to cross the border, the rhythm of, 400,000 people a year in search of the social mobility they cannot find in their home, forced to live with their hand outstretched, waiting for the next token from the next politician, forced to march in the streets because they feel that no one in the government is listening, forced to distrust the institutions, and to witness la muerte común de los sueños, because Mexico, my home, our home, does not move as quickly as it could and as it should. As quickly as it could and as it should. Thank you very much.
Dr. Dresser, for your words. And we would like to open the floor for the Q&A session. I know we're not at the Kennedy School, but at the Kennedy School we have pretty simple rules for Q&A sessions, and I think that they could prove useful tonight. The first rule is, if you're going to ask a question, please say who you are, where you come from. Question number two is, please keep them brief and do it in a respectful way. And rule number three, questions end with a question mark.
And so, rule number four, please don't call me Dr. Dresser. It makes me feel like a dentist. Denise, por favor.
Okay, Denise. And I would like to ask Andres to make the first question. And then we'll open the floor for all of you.
Well, that was, that lived up to the hype. thank you, Denise. That was sobering, though. thoroughly depressed, but I thank you for that. And actually, I'm tempted to call you doctor because at near the end there, you did give us sort of a diagnosis or a prescription for, you know, okay, so how do we resolve the problem? Here's my list. And one of the things that's very depressing about these conversations is, you know, a lot of the things that you point to unleash the potential in Mexico, you don't need a medical degree. You don't have to be a rocket scientist. Choose your metaphor. They are pretty clear. However, you know, how we get there, you know, you have a patient that, in a sense, doesn't want treatment. And you are so convincing and provocative in pointing out just how difficult it is to get the patient to accept treatment, and I'm not sure how we get from here to there. I don't know if very much is clear, but it's...
No, it is.
Because you've said that electoral democracy isn't enough. What's it going to take?
My point of departure for why Mexico doesn't want to change is that I think I've painted a portrait of how convenient this system is for the people who are at the top of the pyramid. I always say that there are few political positions in the world that are better than to be a Mexican politician. Public funding, plurinominales, proportional representation, where if you're on a list, you don't even have to campaign. No accountability. We are in the worst of all worlds because no hay reelección, pero sí hay trampolín. People jump from the Chamber of Deputies to the Senate and then to a municipal presidency and then back to the Chamber of Deputies and then back to the Senate without ever having to return and be accountable to those who elected them. So in many ways, what I think has happened and what we have to fix is we've essentially democratized the game. There are more players in the electoral game, but the game is the same game. It's the game of elite rotation. It's a game that was instituted by the PRI and that has institutionalized this brecha, this enormous void between a political class up here that basically does what it wants. In tandem with its allies in the business sector, and a citizenry down here, which if you're a Mexican citizen, there are few roles that are more frustrating. Because you can write, you can denounce. I can write articles until the cows come home. How is that going to change Mexico if there's no real way in which people like me or any other ordinary citizen can punish those who abuse power, lie, cheat, and steal, and manage to stay in a governorship, move on to another political position, get themselves elected? So unless we create mechanisms for accountability, that we're going to continue to live under that dysfunctional democracy. How would that happen? I'd say one of the it will start to happen the day that Mexico doesn't have oil anymore, or that we face a crisis so severe that important decisions will have to be made about the rules that govern the Mexican economy. Why do I refer to oil? Because I think that oil has financed Mexico's paralysis. Oil has maintained this system in place. Because oil has provided the Mexican government with enough revenue to continue to pay off its clientels and keep people happy, those who live with their hands outstretched. When Mexico runs out of oil, or the price falls much more than where it currently is today, what will the Mexican government be forced to do in order to pay itself and its clientels? It will be forced to raise taxes. It will be forced to carry out a major fiscal reform. And what would that entail? It would lead to a virtuous circle that currently does not exist. In Mexico today, not paying taxes is absolutely rational. because you think, why would I pay them if they're going to end up in the secret account of the president's brother? Okay? In every speech that Barack Obama gives, he mentions the phrase, taxpayer money, taxpayer dollars. When have you ever heard a Mexican politician explain what he's doing with your taxpayer pesos? Doesn't have to, because many of those people out there didn't actually pay them. So the minute in which the Mexican government has to actually cobrar impuestos and people actually pay them, that will in turn, I think, create a demand, an impetus for further for accountability, which we do not have today. If you look at the cycles of reform in Mexico, they've always occurred after a devastating crisis. In 1994, it was after the Zapatista rebellion and the assassination of Colosio. In Mexico, a next cycle of reform will happen when we once again reach our limit. We saw a cycle of electoral reform in 2008 as a result of the very contentious presidential election. But I think we're not done, and I think that there's going to be pressure for this to occur insofar as Mexico, it doesn't look like we're going to come out of this economic crisis anytime soon. So that may be a catalyst.
Hi. Following the rules, my name is Daniel. I'm from Puebla. And by listening at your lecture, I want to ask three very quick questions. The first one is, shall we see the figure of Felipe Calderón as this Superman who wants to save poor souls? And, well, the second one is, I believe that once you get to the, I mean, what you have this paper and what you're going to put your vote on, you shall not do the el menos peor, right? So what are our options for this next 2009 election? Mm-hmm. And the last one is, do you really believe that the problem in the political class can be solved by the political class itself?
I remember when Felipe Calderón got elected, and I was thinking, well, what is this man going to do in terms of transforming Mexico? And a prescient friend of mine said, Denise, lower your expectations. He's not an action hero. And I think he's shown a certain amount of bravado in terms of dealing with the drug issue. Why did he do so? On the one hand, I think he had no choice. I mean, he has said, nos encontramos un tiradero, because 6 years of a Fox administration in which Vicente Fox was much more interested in other things, parenthesis, I always say that you can understand the Fox sexenio in three ways. Frente al PRI se rajó, con Andrés Manuel López Obrador se obsesionó, y con Marta se casó. That's all you need to know. So 6 years of that led to infiltrated institutions, decapitated policemen, and increasing levels of violence. So Calderón knew on the one hand he had to deal with that, and he explicitly said we have to reconquer territory that has been seized by drug traffickers. I also think that he made a strategic calculus in terms of what is the action that is going to generate legitimacy and broad consensus for me in the aftermath of a very contested election. And I think that going after drug traffickers, using the military and presenting, which gave him an opportunity to present a strong hand, a firm hand, is the route that he chose for the reasons that I've outlined. Is he a superhero? No, I think that he has chosen to fight a battle in which he has very few instruments. And he, at the same time, while he is dealing with that particular front, he has argued that because of that, he cannot carry out further reforms in other key areas. If you were here today, he'd say, don't ask me to open up another front with Televisa or with Carlos Slim when I'm fighting a battle to the death with Mexican drug traffickers. So there's a certain credence to that argument. But at the same time, if you don't deal with the other structural issues, you end up administrando la inercia, despite having being able to applaud five reforms that were approved in Congress during his tenure. Our options. A mí siempre me dicen, es que, Denise, eres demasiado antipriista. And I say, es un cumplido. That's a badge of honor. Where are our options? The first option is do not vote for the PRI. Why do I say that? Because the PRI, it's not just a party. It's a way of life. And that way of life, that esos hábitos y costumbres, government as distribution of the spoils, are alive and well in that party. And remember that the PRI that is coming back is not the PRI of the cosmopolitan, Ferragamo tie-wearing techno-bureaucrats who knew how to flirt in several languages of the 1980s and 90s. We're talking about the vintage dinosaurs of the system. So you get the ballot, you do not vote for the PRI. And then after that, you make your own choice. But what you cannot lose sight of is that, yes, we can applaud what has been done, a peaceful transition of power, a voted transition. We managed to remove the PRI from the presidency without bloodshed. You know, the autonomy of the Federal Electoral Institute, the relative cleanliness of our elections, etc. That is simply not enough. If you do not solve the issue of representation and accountability, all you end up doing is crossing that ballot and sending someone off to be in Congress for 3 years and then jump to another post. So when you ask me, can these changes happen only as a result of the political class? Absolutely not. That political class has very few incentives to change the system. They will only do so when people like me and Alejandro Martí and hopefully hundreds and thousands of others understand that this is not working, that this status quo is untenable, and you begin to demand things such as re-election with term limits, que se haga pública la declaración patrimonial de todo servidor público y de toda persona que aspira a un puesto político, that there be very clear laws of conflict of interest. And one of the things that most surprised me, and I'm sorry to be speaking ill of the dead, about the Mourinho case, is when it was made public that he had signed contracts for his family when he was the head of the Energy Commission in Congress, when that news item was reported across the world, it was presented as a clear conflict of interest. And yet in Mexico, it's as if the term didn't exist, because government has been viewed as a vehicle for distribution of the spoils. And I remember people saying at the time, well, there's really no law that sanctions this. Well, the mere fact that there is no law that sanctions this sort of behavior is, I think, very emblematic of what's so wrong with Mexico's democracy and economic system, of the close ties that I am referring to, and to the fact that conflict of interest in Mexico is not a conflict. So that's part of the agenda for change that me and many other people are espousing. And until that agenda becomes the agenda for most Mexicans, you can go and cross your ballot, but Mexico will continue to be pretty much the same country it has been. So, that's my
question. We have another question over here. Just please ask only one question so that other people can have an opportunity to ask their own question.
Hi, Denise. Thank you for being here tonight. I'm from Guernarga, and I'd like to ask your opinion. You talked in your presentation about the possible return of the BRI. Mm-hmm. Do you see this as a threat to returning to an authoritarianism in the country, or maybe as the contrary, but stabilizing democracy in which you have the switch of powers in the presidency?
Well, first of all, a small caveat. This is a very fluid situation. You know, if someone had, if, you know, a reputable political scientist had said 3 years ago, Felipe Calderón is going to be president of Mexico, he would have been laughed out of the room. I mean, that is a significant change in Mexico. We do not know who's going to win. I'm pointing to a trend that has been revealed by recent polls and by electoral victories by the PRI. But in the last 2 weeks, for example, the head of the National Action Party has started a very aggressive campaign trying to remind people of the ills and the woes associated with the PRI, and its margin in the polls has diminished. So I'm not making a prediction about the PRI returning. I'm saying that is a trend that we're witnessing now that can be reversed. Do I view it as something to celebrate because it would be a sign of alternancia? I do not. I think it would be very bad for Mexico for the PRI to return, because it's the PRI that I've been mentioning, and because I'm not sure that the autonomous institutions we've created to provide a counterweight to the power of the presidency or the executive or the power of the political class are strong enough to withstand what would clearly be an effort on the part of the PRI to return to many of the traditional practices. I mean, the PRIistas today say, oh, don't worry, the system is democratic. Of course we can't govern the way we used to govern. And then you look at the list of people who were on the plurinominales. I mean, please, just take a look at the list. And they and you see the names of Murat and I mean so many of the dinosaurs of the PRI, or their sons or their spouses. As I said, I think the PRI has been a way of life. It's not just a political party. If it were just a political party, then I guess I'd be less wary of its return. I think it's a way of exercising power and a way of viewing clientelism as the key mechanism for maintaining itself in power. And this is something that worries me. Were it a party that had conducted a thorough transformation, sought out new ways of selecting its candidates, come out with a clear position on key public policy issues, disowned Mario Marin and Ulises Ruiz and Roberto Madrazo, and distanced itself from the practices that they have become so emblematic of, I think that I would be less concerned than I am today. But this is a party that, I mean, look at an interview I did with Beatriz Paredes 6 months ago on Canal 22, who continues to defend Mario Marin. And I think that is very problematic.
Hi. My name is Jorge. I'm a student at the Kennedy School, and I'm a student of economic development. And the most convincing explanation I find for economic development is one proposed by a group of professors here at Harvard. It says that successful countries are those that don't try to implement a longer list of reforms, but that target the most binding constraint to growth. So if we were to make a parallel to the issues you have covered, what do you think would be the most binding constraint to constructing the rule of law or dismantling these dysfunctional democracies that we have in Mexico?
I think I'd answer your question along focusing on the last part of my talk. Because I think, and maybe I'm being too much of a structuralist here, but I think that the lack of reform in the political system is reflective of the economic structure. I mean, those who benefit from the la estructura piramidal are perfectly happy with this sort of political system where there's no accountability to citizens, where you actually rotate people on the basis of how they support certain public policies, such as the Televisa law or whatever. So what would my remedy be for that? Competition policy across the board. what Australia did, I guess, a decade ago and elevated GDP by, what was it, 3-4%? You know, a concerted effort on the part of the government to dismantle constraints to competition. I think that would be my recipe for Mexico in that regard. Regarding rule of law issues, this is a topic on which I'm really not an expert. And I talked about the overhaul of the judiciary, and I talked about the need for a national police force. I think those would be first good steps. I mean, we have an institutional problem. The fact that, for example, there isn't a police forces are state by state. They're controlled by the governor in turn. And drug trafficking is not a federal offense, for example. So police forces at the local level don't feel compelled to necessarily go after drug traffickers because they say it's a federal issue, the federal government should deal with it. And so many of the governorships are controlled by the PRI that governors have no incentive to push their police forces into doing that. So, for example, there's a law being discussed now, La Ley contra el Narcomenudeo, hoping to nationalize at least drug trafficking at the smaller level to get local police forces involved. But see, that's an area where you'd have to completely redesign the way the police system has been set up, something that governors are opposed to. Because they say, I've never had as much power as when I've been in control of policemen and jails. So I think that's an issue on the agenda. But, you know, invite Beatriz Ana Laura Magaloni. She's the best person in Mexico to talk about this. She has a chapter in this new book, The Obama Administration and the Americas, Challenges for the Future or something. There's a whole chapter there on rule of law in Mexico.
Denise? Hi, my name is Gita, and I'm a filmmaker, not a political. But I want to ask you, because I admire you, I will not vote for the people. But after listening to all this, one really can get very depressed, because I don't think this began with the people. Because before the PRI, there were the caudillos, before the caudillos, there was the church. And so I want to know if you think, or what you think, that the corruption, which I think is a fondo de todo esto, is part of the nature of Mexico.
No, absolutely not. I don't want you to leave here feeling depressed. No, I don't want you to leave here thinking, no hay remedio. I would like you to leave here feeling angry. More than angry, indignant. Because I think being indignant is an integral part of being a good citizen. You know, Gunther Grass has this wonderful phrase about how the obligation of any citizen is vivir con la boca abierta. The problem with Mexico is that too many people don't understand their rights. Too many people do not understand that why should they have to pay the highest rates of any country of the OECD? I mean, why?
Corruption.
When you say, is corruption endemic to Mexico? Is it part of our DNA? See, I reject culturalist. I reject political culture explanations. Thanks to Princeton, I still remember that article. I was. Elkins and Simeon, political culture as a residual variable or something like that. You only appeal to political culture after you've run out of any other explanation. And why do I not believe that it's in our nature to be corrupt? Because it turns out that when Mexicans cross the border, they become law-abiding citizens. They don't beat up their wives. They send their children to school. They accumulate wealth. They pay their taxes. They follow the rules. They obey the traffic signs. And they don't throw wrappers out of their car window. Why do they do that? I mean, did their DNA change when they crossed the border? No. The incentives change. The institutions changed. There is punishment for bad behavior. You know, and a sign of light at the end of the tunnel for Mexico is what we were able to do with the, La Cultura del Fraude. I mean, perhaps some of you here believe that 2006 was massive fraud. I don't believe that. But regardless of that, for between 1994 and 2006, Mexicans went to the polls. They voted. They went there and crossed their boleta. After years, decades, in which we were told that Mexicans would never be able to surmount La Cultura del Fraude, what did we do? We spent $10 billion in 10 years reforming the Federal Electoral Institute with a whole series of measures. Indelible ink and the credencial de elector y las boletas numeradas, in order to change people's attitudes towards the act of voting. I think to a certain extent we've succeeded. The IFE is still one of the most trusted institutions in the country. So the fact that we were able to change that, institutional remodeling does change behavior. I mean, Mexican politicians will stop being corrupt when they're actually punished. Until and unless that happens, corruption will continue to plague the Mexican system. But we live in a... Yo siempre digo que México es el país donde nunca pasa nada. I mean, you can lie, cheat, steal, protect pedophiles, murder citizens in your state's capital, as was the case in Oaxaca, and stay in power. You can sign contracts in your family's name, but if you're the president's friend, you can stay in power. Until we begin to punish that sort of behavior, and citizens demand that it be punished. Because it seemed, that whole period in which we discussed the Mourinho case, it seemed in Mexico that there were only 5 people who were calling for Mourinho's immediate resignation. Why were there only 5 people? Because everybody else thought it was normal. Everybody else thought it was acceptable. It wasn't a deal breaker. I mean, if we don't start to raise the bar, I mean, if Mexicans don't start to believe that they have rights just like citizens everywhere else, the message I'd like for you to take out of here today is not depression. It's rejecting that famous Mexican phrase, which I loathe, por lo menos. Por lo menos, en el sexenio pasado, solo se robaron un jeep rojo y una Hummer. Por lo menos, no ocupamos el último lugar en las evaluaciones PISA de educación. Por lo menos hay paz social. Por lo menos son solo 20 millones de pobres. Antes eran 23 millones de pobres. ¿Sí o no? ¿Cuántas veces al día no escuchan ustedes la palabra, la frase, por lo menos? If you take one message away, it's to eradicate that phrase from your vocabulary and start believing that individuals matter, that people make a difference, that moral courage is something that is to be aspired and applauded and displayed by every Mexican. If we did that, wouldn't it be a different country?
We're running out of time, so this is going to be the last question.
Hi, Denise. First of all, I'm Paco Rubiales, an alum of Kennedy and the MBA and the MBA. Thank you for such a knowledgeable and honest conference. And since the majority of the audience here is composed of young men and women who are going to be steering our countries, Mexico and other countries, into this next century or this century, and they're going to be the policymakers, the decision makers, the business executives, the public officers, the question would be, they're going to be confronted with this thing where they have to go back to these very institutions that you are talking about, reporting to these very individuals who don't want to change. Mm-hmm. So, what's your advice? How do they reconcile the situation where to really make an impact, you have to get into those institutions? Because it's very difficult to say, well, I'm going to, away from that, and I'm going to have my little taqueria, and also that I don't report to those guys that I'm not part of the system. And that's not going to work, because in the taqueria, which I respect very much, which I had one like Felipe's tacos, but I really don't know. The question would be, for them to make an impact and get into those institutions, and then, what's your advice? How do you reconcile this apparent discrepancy?
Well, why do people believe that the only way to change Mexico is within the institutions? I think the problem is that there hasn't been enough pushback from civil society. The problem is that there haven't been enough voices clamoring for things to change. The problem is that too many people view... You exemplified what I'm talking about perfectly when you said, oh, they'll return and they'll, you know, just do their own thing and they'll set up their taqueria. You know? What would be my advice? Many Mexicans, because someone here in the audience said that the problem didn't start with the PRI, it started, you know, with the it started with the viceroys and the colonia and the tlatoanis, and it's been there since the Aztecs. Too many Mexicans believe that the country doesn't belong to them, because it hasn't belonged to them. It has belonged to the tlatoanis and the colonial administration and the imperial presidencies and the intellectuals and the political parties. It's been essentially, and remains, an extreme, an elitist oligarchic system that does not represent citizens. The system was never set up to represent citizens. So people think it belongs to somebody else. And because they believe that their country belongs to somebody else, they don't take care of it. As, you know, former president of Harvard, I don't know how well his name will be received, but Larry Summers has this saying, which I'd like to quote, that no one has ever washed a rented car. Mexicans think their country is a rented car. So they don't wash it. They don't take it to be serviced. They don't, no lo sacuden, no lo aspiran, because they think it's a rented car. So what would it entail to start to think differently about it? Well, recognize that it's yours. My Canadian husband, we live near the Bosque de Chapultepec. When he goes out running every day, he takes a huge black plastic bag and he picks up the garbage that he encounters. And he told me that the last time he went out, he got three different reactions from people. And this is, it's actually very interesting and goes to the heart of your question. A woman stopped him, and the first thing, the only thing she said was, ¿Cómo llego a Virreyes? A second person stopped him and said, ¡Córrele, chingado! And a third person stopped and said, they're the three Mexicos. The person who couldn't care less and only wanted to get to Virreyes. The one who thought, oh, why bother? And the third one who said, and who possibly may start to pick up the garbage. And why does my husband pick up the garbage? Not because he's marvelous and wonderful, although he is. But because he grew up in a country, Canada, where he was taught that public spaces are yours. They belong to you. Their well-being depends upon you. Mexico, the country, is a public space. It is not a rented car. It is your car. And people frequently ask me after conferences, but, you know, what can I do? What should I do? What can an ordinary citizen do? And I reach the point where I say, pick up the garbage. I know that all of you would like a heroic task, something that was more sophisticated, more elegant. Picking up, what does picking up the garbage mean? It means making the country yours. It means taking care of your public space. It means being involved in the public space. And hopefully picking up the garbage will lead you to wonder why is there so much garbage? Why don't other people pick it up? I should start organizing the neighbors to pick up the garbage. We should go and confront the delegada because it's her responsibility to pick up the garbage. Imagine los círculos concéntricos, virtuosos, that foundational act of appropriation would create in a country such as Mexico. So I guess I leave you with that message. Pick up the garbage.
Taking place tomorrow and Friday. Tomorrow we're going to have Alfredo Cochalo, who's going to talk about reporting about drug trafficking. And on Friday we're going to have the Attorney General of Baja California, who will talk about how to confront the Tijuana cartel. Thank you. Tomorrow it's 4 p.m. in this place, and on Friday it's a Fong Auditorium in Boston Hall at 1.
Andrés, muchísimas gracias.
Thank you.
¿Alguien olvidó esto?
I found this on the
where
on the right on the podium.
Oh, in, which no, but inside. inside.
You weren't inside?
No, there was another group from the, I think, the Chinese.
No, it was a Mexican studies group.
Oh, was it?
Really?
Oh,
yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. I'm not sure.
So it gets us access to guys like him.
He found this on the podium.
Oh, that's probably the nieces. That's the recorder.
I wish I had mine.
I'll keep it.